Thanks very much. And thanks so much, David, for inviting me to Ireland. I've been a long admirer of this man for standing up for the righteous cause and for being brave. I would absolutely hate to see my name one day and trending on Twitter and getting that sort of abuse. But I think, as Churchill has said, courage is the most. I think it's Churchill. It's one of these quotes that's always attributed to Churchill, like everything is, but maybe it's not him. Courage is the most important virtue, because without courage, all the others come to nothing. And he's shown courage. I grew up in London, so I'm just set my timer so I don't talk too much. I grew up in London, and I've been coming to Dublin particularly, but Ireland generally, since I was a child, summers and Christmas here, and I still go a couple of times a year, see family, sometimes work, sometimes bring my own kids. And it's really noticeable how rapid Ireland has changed, in good ways and bad ways. Obviously, much wealthier than it used to be. Wealthier than England, although lots of places are wealthier than England now. But in many ways, that are kind of disconcerting. I remember sort of 20 years ago with another friend who's also Irish parents, talking about, one day when we'll just we'll escape. If I, England becomes so completely insane, we can always go to the old country and move there, and houses can be cheaper, it's not like London. And obviously that dream has now died. But things in England are still, it's easy to think things are uniquely terrible in your own country. But I mean, I was in Manchester last weekend for the Tory Party conference, which had a sort of general air of despair and hopelessness about it. And the main takeaway of the story was that the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, had said that a man is a man and a woman is a woman. And afterwards, even a couple of journalists actually said, well, actually, he's breaking the Equality Act, and maybe he should be reported to the police for this. And I just thought it'd be an amazing way to end the whole sort of 13 years. He ends up having to fight the election while in prison for stating this is such a bland, kind of boring thing to say. And people often say, when commenting about this, like, imagine you're in a coma. I mean, imagine 10 years in a coma, even 5 years in a coma, you wake up and this is the main thing being debated. Someone's saying something so bland. But we've sort of been here before. I don't know if people here are on TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, obviously. I'm 45 years old, but I've tried banning it in my household amongst with the kids. But I tell them it's a sort of Chinese Communist Party bioweapon to sort of destroy our brains. But there was a thing recently about why men in particular are obsessed with the Roman Empire, and how many times you think about the Roman Empire. And I've been thinking about the Roman Empire a lot recently. Especially the last years of the Roman Empire, because it's a sort of running obsession of mine that we are enduring, going through the same sort of cultural revolution that happened in the 4th century Rome, which wasn't, it was before the fall of the Roman Empire, and it wasn't actually, despite what Gibbon said, the cause of it, but it was just the biggest shake-up a society's ever seen, and this is what we're seeing now. I mean, there's the famous story of the Seven Sleepers. It was a group of seven Christians and their dog. Who went into a cave in the year 250 AD to escape persecution by Decius, the Emperor Decius. And then they wake either 196 years later, or some sources 373 years later, but a long time anyway. And when they come, during the reign of the Emperor Theodosius, around the year 456, they're woken up, and they wake up and they think they've only been there for a night, and they go out, and then they find that their religion, which had been completely persecuted, and which was kind of despised, and it was a sort of minority religion, is now everywhere. That, the symbols of the religion everywhere. Everyone is a believer, and even if everyone's not a believer, they have to pretend to be. And I often think about what someone would think if they'd gone to sleep in sort of 1960 or 1963, which is apparently the year when sex was invented in England, and what if they woke up in the current year? They would go to a capital city in Europe, like Dublin or London or Vienna or Berlin, or pretty much all the cities. They would see this sort of strange flag everywhere, variations of this flag, flying from every building, flying from all the embassies. If you visited in June, they would see these parades, these sort of religious-like parades, but not quite like Corpus Christi, as he remembered, people wearing fewer clothes. He would watch television and see people looking, not just using sort of systemic imagery, but in a way that's not even very interesting. It's quite boring that people are doing that. You might even see people increasingly identifying as witches. Or one university in England offering a degree in magic. If you went to Canterbury Cathedral, which is the seat of the English Church since St. Augustine, and it was the place of martyrdom for St. Thomas Becket. He was, hosting school disco nights featuring the Spice Girls and S Club 7 and Britney Spears. That was from just this week. I mean, more sinisterly, he would go hear about people in Finland who have been put on trial for their Christian beliefs, accused of hate speech, and interviewed by the police because they questioned their church's partnership with the Pride Festival. I mean, this has been going on for 2 years now. Even worse, he would read about dozens of churches being vandalized and arsoned and burned down in Canada, which followed, as was mentioned earlier, this hysteria about mass graves. Hysteria that's fueled by politicians in which no one seems to have apologized for. I mean, just this week, this Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, he tweeted, "Indigenous women, girls, and two SLGBTQQIA plus people are valued and deserve better. As we mark Sister and Spirits Day, we remember those who've been murdered or are missing, and we stand with their families and communities." He would also see, our sleeper, churches being pulled down all over England and France in particular. So early this year, in Oldham in Lancashire, a 170-year-old church was pulled down by the council over fears it would attract vandals and become an eyesore blighting the local area, which actually discredits the vandals. At least they actually left churches when they sacked Rome. And this is the third city in just this small town in the north of England which has been pulled down by authorities because, you know, frankly, no one's going anymore. Church burnings in France are very commonplace. If you go to France, you'll see so many empty churches now. Many derelict ones. You know, our sleeper also noted that blasphemy laws are no longer in use, and if artists are free to, you know, mock Christ or the Virgin Mary, and in fact they're given subsidies to. But they also noticed there are new and far stricter blasphemy laws out there that replace them. I mean, no one in England has gone to jail for a century now for blaspheming against the Christian faith, and in that case, he was a sort of self-made martyr who repeatedly did it, actually wanted to go to jail. But just last year, a man in England went to jail for 4 months for a private joke in a WhatsApp group about George Floyd. And so, you know, this came after, you know, 2 years after very religious scenes of kind of hysteria that followed the death of this man in America, which at the time just seemed so utterly bizarre to those of us sort of stuck in lockdown, watching this on our laptops or whatever. I mean, think a convicted criminal put to death in the powerful empire having such a big effect on the world. Someone who had gone to, who had been, you know, in a coma for 6 years will also note that things like infanticide and suicide become widespread and legal. And in some cases paid for the state, and in the case of suicide, for physically healthy people. This comes with a widespread social air of pessimism and anxiety that hangs over society, an obsession with mental health in particular. You know, what our sleeper would conclude correctly is that the West has undergone repaganization. Western society has returned to the norms that had once been universal in the world, but had been upended by the Christian Revolution. This was the subject of a book that came out in France, and pardon, I'm going to pronounce this French word in a very English way, so I do apologize it. As French author Chantal Desol wrote a book called La Fin de la Chrétienne, the end of the Christian world, which hasn't actually been translated in English yet. And she saw the start of this being the 1960s, the West legalization of abortion, Pope John the 23rd. And she said, just as Christians brought a normative inversion to the pagan Rome, overturning its old moral order, the same thing is happening again with sexuality being at the center. You know, the scale of this change has been very, very rapid. But just in 60 years, all our kind of social norms have been changed, and what were once very, very Christian societies are now pagan again. Because in Britain, until 2010, every single leader of the British Labour Party, with one exception, had been a practicing Christian. He had been an agnostic. And since then, everyone has been an atheist. Today, only 46% of British people identify as Christian in the latest census, and that's down from 72% just 2 decades. That's a huge change. And in America as well, which had long been thought immune to the secularization of like France and Britain, the majority of Americans under 40 are now not Christian. And the same thing is happening with Ireland, of course. It was said, you know, that Ireland Christianized very rapidly and almost without bloodshed, kind of almost uniquely, I think, in the Christian world. And similarly, it's adopted progressive politics incredibly quickly. He's now amongst the most enthusiastic in being, I suppose, anti-Christian or post-Christian. But, you know, the thing is, people tend to assume that their cultural upbringing, one we've all known, is the norm in human nature, and that human beings all behave the same. When in fact, Christianity is very strange, it's very counterintuitive. While paganism, and I'll get into the definition, is normal. It's the kind of universal human behavior. So when I say paganism, I don't mean people sacrificing goats and, you know, dressing up as druids. Although those kind of things are on the rise today, and in the US, 1.5 million people identify as pagans, whatever that means. It's a rise of tenfold in 20 years. There are also self-identified witches, popular on TikTok, which is another reason I'm banning it. And at the start of the Ukrainian war, some prominent witches in the States even put a hex on President Putin, although it hasn't seemed to make much difference. But so what I say is paganism is the default beliefs and behaviors in human societies, which Christianity went against. I mean, Christianity is very unusual in many ways. It has far more emphasis on miracles than other religions. Even the idea of the afterlife isn't universal or common. The celibate priesthood is not common. It's not normal for society to place such levels of shame on the aristocracy, especially aristocratic men. It's much more normal for aristocratic men to dominate and crush their enemies and to sexually exploit as many women as possible. The emphasis on forgiveness is especially weird. And weird is the acronym used to describe how Western society is developed by Joseph Henrich in his book, The Weirdest People in the World. It stands for Western, Educated, Industrial, Rich, and Democratic. And his point is that kind of behavior, which we have all taken as the norm, is very, very strange. And similarly about, you know, perhaps most unusual of all is Christianity's attitude to suicide and infanticide. So Canada, which I mentioned before, is perhaps the most extremely changed of all Western countries. In the 60s, it was very religious. Quebec was incredibly Catholic, very high birth rates, and English-speaking Canada was very conservative, being founded by conservative opponents of the revolution. Today, it is amongst most extreme, I hate to use the word woke, but it is. That's the closest news. And on the subject of suicide, it's way out there now with a very, very controversial suicide program run by the states. And in a recent poll, almost over 40% of young Canadian people said that access to euthanasia should be given just on the grounds of poverty. So they think that if someone is poor, it's okay for the state to basically kill them. You know, Canadian television, this is a very Black Mirror kind of episode where they had this sort of classy advert, which looked like it could have been an advert for a fragrance or an upmarket fashion house. And it was actually an advert for assisted suicide with a woman talking about upcoming death. And the bleakest thing is afterwards, it revealed that she was actually very sick and she wanted to get better. She wasn't able to get the treatment she wanted. And that was it. And then there's infanticide, which is even more controversial, more of a source of conflict in the modern world. And Louise Perry, who's an English journalist, she wrote in First Things recently about archaeologists, when they look over Roman sites, the first thing they look for to see if something's a brothel is there will always be the bodies of newborns underneath it. So it's something she said she only learned when she was pregnant. She found incredibly upsetting. But then obviously it makes sense. You know, she admitted, and she's not a churchgoer, and she said she's not actually against legal abortion. So she said, but to mention abortion and infanticide in the same breath is provocation. But this distinction has not been made by all peoples and all times, and that is entirely true. Infanticide was completely widespread in the ancient world. Almost all cultures had something similar, where a baby would be presented, and at some point, maybe like 7 or 8 days, the father would publicly accept the child, or he wouldn't. I mean, Sparta is the most famous case where children were simply thrown literally to the wolves. And we think of Sparta as an incredibly cruel society, but that was completely normal. There is a surviving letter from a Roman aristocrat to his wife saying, blah, blah, blah. And then says, oh yeah, and the baby you're carrying, if it's a boy, name him such and such. If it's a girl, just some sort of euphemism for killer. And that was completely normal. And the Romans noticed that the only people in their world who didn't do this. There were two small German tribes who didn't practice this. And at the other end of the empire, the Jews. So historians chart Christianity's demographic rise and triumph in the fourth century, in part because it had such overwhelming, much larger scores amongst women. They know this because they have records of some of the Christian communities, and there are far more women are recorded, and there were quite a few women even at the top of these communities. And they were in particular attracted by the opposition to infanticide and divorce and to same-sex relations, which are all the things that young women, secular women, disliked about the church now. What happened was that women would convert to this religion, and then men would follow as secondary converts, which means they basically converted to please their wives. And this was, I mean, this is true in English history. Our first king, Ethelbert of Kent, who invited, allowed St. Augustine to convert this kingdom. He converted because his wife was a Frankish Christian, and the Franks also, the same reason, that Clovis, the first Frankish king, his wife's Christian. And so the domination of women in the dominance of women in transmitting faith has been a recurring feature of religious history in the West, at least, not so much in the Islamic world. It's also found in Methodism in the 18th century, which was disproportionately female. And this is a process which completely revolutionized Western society, but it's also one that we now feel, certainly in England, people feel very differently about. Even if you watch historical dramas, about sort of the Vikings, they didn't tend to present the Vikings as kind of fun-loving and sympathetic, while the Christian Saxons are kind of puritanical, sexual hypocrites. And even though Viking society had aspects to it which were completely horrific to us, like human sacrifice, which we know now was not Christian propaganda, which was very widespread. And yet, today, we are going through arguably the biggest cultural transformation since the 4th century. During the lockdown, I don't know if everyone remembers 2020, it's just kind of blurted out of everyone's mind. I read during that time, lots of time in hand, Edward Watts, an American academic, wrote a book called The Final Pagan Generation, which is about the Roman aristocracy of the 4th century, with their good records of them, their lives. And this, he particularly focuses on the conservative pagan aristocracy, who had grown up, you know, they had worshipped the same gods for a thousand years. And they had no concept that this religious sort of cult, if they saw it, which was popular amongst certain urban communities, was going to actually take over their society. And it was published in 2015, but it made seem so timely in 2020 because he recorded how this Christianity actually surged in popularity during a period, the plague of Cyprian. It was a great pestilence. And before that plague, Christians had been a small minority, were now suddenly everywhere. Their processions were everywhere, their icons were everywhere. And for these kind of pagan Christian, I mean, pagan conservative Romans, this is like very disturbing. And I just felt some empathy watching kind of scenes in America, this kind of religious like outpouring that, you know, my entire world is completely almost disappearing in front of me. This is an entire new world. And I'm going to be like one of these Romans in the fourth century, just bemoaning everything, you know, changing. And you know, he wrote about how the gods were everywhere, and there were signs of them everywhere, and all of a sudden they just seemed to disappear. People just stopped believing them. The tutors stopped teaching their children about these gods existing, and then eventually they just disappeared. And the sort of the sad thing is that, you know, he says these men and women were the mid fourth century silent majority. Yeah, a majority that remains silent soon becomes a minority. And part of it would have been, I wouldn't say persecution, but there was intolerance on the Christian part once they became dominant. I mean, people tend to be less, I suppose, in favor of tolerance when they're in positions of, you know, power. But a lot of it was just social pressure. People were just embarrassed to raise a fuss, and they had careers to get on with. And if you wanted to, you know, court favor with the emperor and his associates, it just wasn't good to complain about the new religion. It wasn't good to cause a fuss. And then by the end of it, their kind of world had completely disappeared. You know, so that comes down to the issue of courage. It takes a lot of courage for people to sort of have, there are social costs involved to sort of stick with your faith. I mean, and you know, even what's notable is that even as Roman politicians, Even the Roman emperors were overtly, by this stage, Christian. Some of the older conservative pagans still sort of convinced themselves that actually the Roman the authorities are still on their side. They just couldn't believe it was actually changing. And in some cases, they, you know, they sort of hedged their bets, which sort of reminded me of the churches today often speaking the language progressivism and sort of courting secular politicians who otherwise make their religion, basically suppress their religion and undermine it. It's almost like in the graves in early medieval England, you see people buried with a cross and Thor's hammer because, you know, they just want to hedge their bets. So what's observed that pagan Roman elites tend to avoid conflict and then they lost. And then what Roman, but what, I mean, I say this, but I say it kind of in a mixed feelings because what actually came, the sort of revolution was actually overwhelmingly a good thing. I mean, what Roman aristocrats particularly disliked was that the faith overturned their power because this new religion had a kind of spiritual equality between men and women, between the rich and poor, and even the free and slave. And then the new religion, even slave women could have immense sort of spiritual power, which was just totally bizarre idea to the Romans. You know, their idea of the pity for the poor, they just didn't have the sense of pity for the poor. I mean, one other reason why Christians are also so successful is because they engage in what will now be called welfare. You know, they actually set up the sort of welfare state, which the pagans just didn't really have that concept of that. They just thought the poor would just die. But most of all, it's on sexual matters where things change. You know, Christianity, Tom Holland wrote a wonderful book called Dominion a few years ago, and he wrote about how it introduced a revolution to the erotic. He said the insistence of scripture that a man and a woman, whenever they took to the marital bed, were joined as Christ and his church were joined, becoming one flesh, gave to both a rare dignity. If the wife was instructed to submit to her husband, then so equally was the husband instructed to be faithful to his wife. He said, here by the standards of the age into which Christianity had been born was an obligation that demanded an almost heroic level degree of self-denial. It's just very, it goes against the grain of most societies. So divorce was prohibited, and to leave a wife was to render her adulteress, as Christ had said. Even more radical was what happened afterwards. The church developed even stricter rules, you know, the banning of, most importantly, the issue of consent, that people could no longer be forced into marriage on their parents' say-so, which was a completely revolutionary idea. And Christianity placed these great restraints on male sexual desires, stigmatizing divorce, prostitution, and the use of female slaves for sex, which so a Roman man was just not even a moral issue, would have just been completely acceptable. And then infanticides, which had been practiced especially against girls, was also banned. And I mean, even that can still be seen now in things in India, for example, in the demographic studies, where there is a huge shortfall of girls amongst Hindu and Muslim communities. It's just not, doesn't exist in the Christian population there. It had a huge effect. So Dale Sol wrote that they prized, of the Christians, that they prized much that the Romans held in contempt and condemned much that the Romans prized, particularly in matters related to sex and family. And so that is essentially what we're having seen again. So of the last, in the 21st century, the most dramatic social trend for the entire world has been the secularization in the United States. Which has been, in 20 years, has been incredibly rapid. More than any other trend in the world, it has had huge influences on all the politics of all our countries. And if, you know, if there are political and social trends in Ireland or in England or elsewhere in the English-speaking world and continental Europe, a great deal of these depend on that huge change. Because this social change has gone on tandem with a lot of social trends, most of them negative. So, for example, there's the extreme rise in loneliness amongst young Americans in particular, with lots of men now say they have no friends whatsoever, which I find it's just a heartbreaking fact. In teenage girls, there's a huge rise in anxiety, self-harm and eating disorders, and especially gender dysphoria, which is encouraged by the state and the authorities. And then there's also drug overdoses and suicide, which have risen hugely in the US. It's only the second country not at war to experience a decline in life expectancy. The first was the Soviet Union in the 60s. So despite their vast wealth, which, you know, from an English point of view seems incredible, Americans are very unhappy. And in Europe, the biggest drop in well-being has been amongst countries which have seen the most huge drop in religion, Spain and Poland being having the least happy young people now. And everywhere people talk about the mental health crisis. Britain now has a minister for mental health, which is it's just bizarre. I mean, we used to have one that's called the Pope. I mean, but you know, as Melanie is saying, it has such a religion has such a huge influence on people's well-being. I mean, in Madrid, for example, that the authorities have set up something called the crying rooms, where you can just go along and cry. Just, I don't know why. So, you know, in the US, there's been an epidemic of painkillers and antidepressants. And the opioid epidemic in particular has been responsible for the biggest cause of the decline of life expectancy. And there was a recent drama about this called Dope Sick, which is pretty, it was good. And it focused on a West Virginia community which has seen sort of drugs go through it. It's OxyContin, it's an incredibly lethal drug. But it's interesting that it barely barely focused on on religion in that community. Except there's one character who's gay and their parents are sort of bigoted homophobes. You know, I suppose that's just that's the Netflix attitude. But there's no consideration that the decline of religion in these communities has had a massive influence on people's ability to withstand pain and to withstand just you know, the downsides of life. I mean, there is considerable evidence that religious belief does actually increase our physical ability to withstand pain, which is kind of obvious when you read all the Lives of the Saints books, which, you know, we all read as children about the incredible endurance that the martyrs went through. But then, so all these social trends are, in my view, obviously linked to the decline of religious faith, even though that is not really something that's sort of talked about in the endless debates about mental health that we have in England. And then there is the biggest side effect of secularization, which is the decline in birth rates. Now, all across the first world, governments are now paying out more and more money to encourage couples to have children. I mean, it's not just sort of Hungary. I mean, lots of countries in Central Europe now, but South Korea is now paying huge amounts of people to have children. And it's just not having any impact at all. Their fertility rates are at the lowest in the world, I believe. I think it's less than one per family. Because the main thing is these material benefits can only go so far. It's so linked to spiritual matters. I mean, one reason why I think the fertility goes with religion is because successful religions are basically parenting guides. They provide templates for raising children and instructions on how they behave. And it's, you know, this honor thy father and mother makes it so much easier to win those kind of endless tussles and battles with, you know, children and teenagers who are always asking why. And not only literally written in stone, but religious societies have that kind of backup from authority parents all around, which makes it easier to raise a family and raise a community. But what makes it harder is that the moral support around parents is now gone as well. You know, society tends to, you know, subversion is so prized and so valued. So, and subversion against family authority has been the central sort of aspect of the 60s sort of revolution. There was a book that came out 50 years ago, Daniel Bell. He wrote about the hedonistic impact of capitalism. He said, "The rejection of authority has come to mean the rejection of any notion of parents other than the peer group itself." Yet one wonders whether such a society is theologically or even psychologically possible. I mean, that was written 50 years ago, and he's kind of showing that it's not really possible. It's only since secularization, though. Britain is further down. Britain started seeing huge declines in religion a fair bit before Ireland. But it's only really in the last 10 years in Britain and in the States where there's been more and more sociological literature on the benefits of religion, almost all from non-believers. And I guess it's normal that we sort of only miss something once it's gone. But amongst them, I mentioned Tom Holland's Dominion, and there's also Larry Seidentrop's Inventing the Invigil, which both looked at how Christianity eventually invented liberalism and individualism as an idea. And Henrik's Weirdest People in the World also looked at how the ban on cousin marriage by the church made Western Europeans very unusually individualistic, and it actually made democracy possible. I mean, there is actually data comparing how long a country was Catholic by how easy it is to run a democracy. And countries which have had long influence of the Catholic Church are just much better primed towards democracy because they tend to have that individualism, which is a product of Christianity. The question always asked about wokeness, if we can even define it, is whether it has a kind of religious aspect. And it's paradoxical because progressivism, I mean, so I prefer to call it progressivism woke, because wokeness, no one really knows what it means and people get confused. And people just mean it to mean things they don't like or, you know, or liberal, which is not the same thing. It's paradoxical because it's both sort of pagan and anti-Christian, but it's also sort of hyper-Christian. It's a sort of heresy of Christianity. You know, the first shall be last and last shall be first is a central part of sort of social justice politics. And you know, Tom Holland has said that it's about who gets to be on the cross, you know, the various competing victimhood identities. And the fact that they've become so extreme is because they are partly in competition. And Del Sol mentioned that Christian civilization took various aspects of pagan Greece and Rome. And so it's kind of inevitable that the next civilization takes aspects of Christianity. So those, instead of Rome, Athens, and Jerusalem, it's more like Rome, Harvard, and Silicon Valley sort of mixed them together. You know, like Christianity, modern universalism, progressivism is universal, and it's determined to save every soul on earth, although it talks about the language of rights. It's as long as there are human rights being violated, they must act. Like the old faith, it's very dominant in the cities, most cosmopolitan areas. It's more popular amongst younger women. You know, in US, Britain, and even Poland, younger women tend to overwhelmingly vote for very left-wing progressive parties. You know, the new religion even has its virtuous pagans. There was a recent St. Francis of Assisi exhibition in London, which called him an ally of causes related to social justice, interreligious dialogue, socialism, feminism, the animal rights movement, and ecology. So, you know, they pick the, you know, the good Christians, and they want to bring them into the into their faith. I mean, and all this quasi-religious nature was obviously most clear in 2020 when there were these kind of groups roaming around, which many people at the time kind of compared to the medieval flagellants. You know, they were even seen as a feet washing towards people, you know, the members of the sacred race. And it's felt kind of, you know, strangely, peaking aspects of Christianity, it was, you know, strangely religious. And it also involved sort of ancestor worship and earth worship, which was sort of, the, you know, the default pagan forms of religion. Although only certain types of ancestors are allowed to be revered. And, you know, this, the great radicalization of opinion we call the Great Awakening, the, you know, the rise of these extreme kind of views on race and gender, kind of it kind of dates from 2012, around, you know, the same time that religion is starting to go to into freefall. And they, you know, and in George Floyd, there's obviously sort of almost like a Christ-like figure, you know, which would be blasphemous to most people, but to the British authorities, you would actually go to jail for blaspheming George Floyd. So, and I'm not even joking. So, you know, this radicalization had lots of material causes, but a huge influence was the decline of religion. So, you know, surveys today say 30% of liberal Americans find a great deal of meaning in politics, compared to only 9% of conservatives. So people lose their religion, then politics becomes their religion. Sometimes this kind of religious aspect of the woke movement is kind of overt. So Nancy Pelosi, who's a, you know, Speaker of the House of Representatives, she thanks George Floyd for sacrificing your life for justice because of you, thousands, millions of people around the world who came out for justice. Your name will always be synonymous justice. I mean, it's theologically literal, obviously. He didn't sacrifice his life. You know, he was murdered. He didn't choose that. But, so, you know, these things are all around. If you go to schools in London, everything in June is Pride. It's basically mandatory. October is Black Heritage Month, Black History Month. And it's even notionally Christian schools are decked out in this. But, you know, the most extreme example is gender identity, which someone's soul can someone might be separated from their body in some way. And this is, the, you know, the most extreme aspect of progressive movements. And it's followed by even people who tell us to trust the science in other cases. I mean, when I first started writing about 15 years ago, it was about the new atheism conflict in Britain. And lots of sort of people were making, I mean, I didn't default their actual arguments to say if that's what we believe, that's fine. But what I find sort of tedious is the fact that all these kind of comments, these points were so old anyway, and that the idea that you would make society more rational and happy by eradicating the last trace of Christianity seemed obviously not true. And now today, the new atheist movement, so many of its kind of leading followers have become extreme progressive kind of believers. They don't believe in transubstantiation, but they believe in that a man can become a woman, and that's kind of become this central point. Even Professor Dawkins, he's probably the only one who's sort of come out with any credit, has been basically excommunicated. So the idea that you can simply go from one religion to a sort of super rational society where people don't have their beliefs is obviously untrue. It's obviously impossible. But then in many ways, it's not so much like a religion as more like a millennial cult. People compare the current kind of crop of progressives, the Puritans, but the Puritans were incredibly effective people. They built the most powerful country in the world. While progressivism tends to correlate with high levels of neurosis, anxiety, mental illness, and very low fertility. It's much more like a cult in that way, similar to political movements early 20th century, Bolshevism being the obvious example. But then there is Nazism, which I am not comparing the modern movement to Nazism, but Nazism was perhaps the first overtly pagan of modern belief systems. It wasn't overtly anti-religious, it was the most, in its iconography and its beliefs and its basic themes, it was much more like a traditional pagan religion. Again, it's not to compare the two, but it does have a strain of, but all these movements do have a strain of intolerance and a sort of common post-Christian theme. So finally, I would say, what happens after this? How do we all live together? Now, the problem is that liberalism arose out of Christianity, and that's the theme of many of the books of recent years. And liberalism arose because Christians of different churches needed to find a way to coexist politically without fighting each other after the huge wars of the early modern era. But liberalism also meant an acceptance of other people's, not just beliefs, but their strong disagreements. What we have now is something quantifiably different. Modern progressives are not really, they don't just demand that you accept their political beliefs, they want affirmation. This is where Edward Skidelsky once put it, that the demand for affirmation entails a new form of intolerance, all the more powerful for not being recognized as such. But logically, if affirmation is required, non-affirmation is forbidden. And this is really sped up in the last 10 years. A turning point was gay marriage because it provided what would be a sort of modern day test act. And in Britain, various politicians have been forced out of their jobs for refusing to agree to this. The British Liberal Democrat leader, Tim Farron, was one example. And one of the candidates for the Scottish National Party was repeatedly quizzed about the issue. And it's just hard for different worldviews to coexist in some ways in a kind of happy way. So this system has been, what we have now has been called a soft totalitarianism. It's a system best defined as a legal and cultural regime in which the expression of morally and socially conservative ideas and opinions is aggressively policed and punished by a combination of legal and social sanctions backed up by corporate power. This intolerance has many new forms, but one of the key ones is the rise of hate speech laws, which aren't really about hatred because certain hatreds are tolerated, even celebrated, but they're really about deviations from sort of social beliefs that are accepted. And this is one way in which Ireland is at the head of the curve. And so is Scotland, actually. Scotland has some of the strictest hate laws around. And again, looking back on the Rome, this makes me feel like sort of one of the old believers who's been slowly pushed out of the public realm. Because you don't need harsh punishments most of the time. You just need social pressures enough. Most of those pagan temples, as far as we know, that the modern scholarship suggests that they weren't knocked down, they weren't burned down, there were no mobs. They were just kind of left to rot and to fester. Maybe occasionally a local council knocked them down because they were an eyesore or something, but people just kind of stopped caring. And I think that's the danger we have today as being in a religious minority, that the various different social forces will make Christians smaller and smaller in number, and it'll make our civilizational change will happen while we're asleep. I would say, finally, there is a general worry that what happens now? I mean, does the new civilization basically inherit the same ones as the old? I'm not entirely sure. I think Christian ideas about pacifism and unworldliness and forgiveness are so unusual, really, in the greatest sort of in greater human history that we would be a bit too confident to suggest otherwise. Already, I think liberalism is definitely in such steep decline as a result. I just think it's so unnatural for most people to want to accept the sort of political and moral beliefs of others. It takes such huge efforts, and it took hundreds of years of Christianity to make that happen. I suppose there are two possibilities. One, that Christianity, as some have said, it provides a sort of civilizational liftoff for trust and individualism and liberalism and human rights, after which our civilization reaches a certain level of development. And then there is the other possibility that it doesn't. And in that case, we just revert to paganism again. Thank you. Hello. No, I just think in Britain, mental health is talked about a lot, where it's become a very common subject. And there is a growing awareness that more and more people are anxious and unhappy in some way. And I believe that it's probably strongly linked to religious decline. And not just religious belief, but also religious attendance. I mean, a lot of it just comes down to loneliness. People don't. Even if people go to church once a week and they meet people, that's going to make a big difference to their well-being. I just find it strange that all that this aspect is almost never talked about. There's a lot about sort of talking about your mental health, but there's nothing about like, there's Robert Burton, the 17th century writer. He talked, he said, "Be not idle, be not lonely." That's like the main, if you're not talking to people and if you're not active, you're going to be miserable. So I don't know enough about what kind of medications, whether that's the right issue in what cases, but anyone else? Hello.
Well, if civilization is Christian,
Yeah.
progressive idea, was it not the rise
I wouldn't be that reactionary even. No, I mean, I tend to think that the Reformation was an extension of the changes that were already happening. And in some cases, it kind of accelerated. Secularization was kind of almost an inevitable. Christianity has a seed of its own almost kind of destruction, in the sense that it creates secularization. But no, I wouldn't say there's any kind of perfect point where everything was right. I'm not like a total civilizational pessimist. I think things can still continue on the right. I mean, the 11th and 12th century was when our kind of modern ideas, our world was kind of created, really. I mean, I definitely do believe the medieval Catholic Church created liberalism and individualism. But it's just difficult for people to, it's difficult for people to coexist with people who really annoy them because they believe different things. And if you look at social media, and, I mean, America's the most extreme example because, politics is so almost religious-like. It's almost like having two religious faiths. and there's just almost no there's no way of stepping over this kind of fundamental different worldviews. I don't know. I think it's arguable to go back. I don't know. Is that?
I don't.
I mean, I suppose Americans say Thomas Jefferson's Virginia. I mean, that sort of made freedom of religion itself.
Right.
I mean, that was, I think, the first example where anyone can believe whatever they want.
Right.
I mean, he's obviously been cancelled for different reasons. But, hello. Right, yeah. You mean as an individual, or if I controlled the state, sort of thing? Heaven forbid. I mean, I've got teenage girls, and some of their friends are, you know, saying call me they and stuff. I'm not very good at dealing with it because I just tend to say no, that's not true. You can't change sex. There's no such thing as non-binary. I know that's probably the worst. That's probably not helpful. I mean, there's two schools of thoughts, aren't there? It's like, okay, they might if you like go against them, they might rebel more. But I'm not entirely sure. I mean, most of the people who tend to, there seems to be people who get caught up in that tend to have parents who slightly enable it or support it, or at least progressive to a certain extent. I mean, 7 or 8 seems incredibly young. I mean, my feeling on that, maybe it's probably different in England, is that that is one area where there has been such a retreat. Like, public opinion is so much hardened against the kind of more extreme transgender movement. Partly because Britain's sort of secular feminists are incredibly effective, and they've basically kind of won the war. So I'm kind of hoping, I reckon in 5 or 10 years that might have moved even further, but that might be unduly optimistic. I think it's kind of almost like that might just be a fad. I mean, children say lots of things, right? I mean, right. I think in so when I went to school in the 90s, like no one was out as gay, and if they were, they would just get beaten up. And I do think, for example, there is evidence that like very strong anti-bullying norms and anti-bullying campaigns in schools do stop that to a certain extent. I mean, that is the argument for that kind of pride. But I mean, if you look at, you know, it's very hard in the sort of secular public realm to argue against pride, because it's just like, oh, it's just for like celebrating people different, it's fine. I mean, I tend to think it kind of has such a almost like a religious feel. I think it's not fair to force all parents to send their kids. So you can say, well, we disagree with that, but we want anti-bullying norms. As for, you know, 7 or 8 years, I mean, I would just, I've had these arguments. I mean, I've had this conversation with my children because, you know, one of them who's at Christian schools, you know, told by a teacher, you have to accept if someone says they're now a woman. And I said, that's just not true because they're not. I said, that's like, and I have to say, your teacher's an idiot. I'm sorry, but which is not a very helpful thing when I talk about, you know, the crisis of authority. I would say on that thing, I would just use biological arguments rather than faith ones. But I mean, that someone like that suggests that they probably do. There is some emotional turmoil that has to be addressed in some way. I think it's possible to do that in a kindly manner.